chemists in 1970, Henri Taillefer published a paper with the anodyne title Experiments in Intergroup Discrimination. It would prove among the most important in social psychology, and even today, it stands as one of the most unnerving windows into the subroutines of the human mind. Taillefer began by recalling a Slovene friend of his detailing the stereotypes his countrymen had for Bosnian immigrants. Taillefer doesn't record what those stereotypes were, but they stuck with him. He thought he had heard them, or something like them, before. He decided to test his hunch. Some time later I presented this description to a group of students at the University of Oxford and asked them to guess by whom it was used and to whom it referred, he writes. The almost unanimous reply was that this was the characterization applied by native Englishmen to colored immigrants, people coming primarily from the West Indies, India, and Pakistan. One from this, Taillefer took a lesson. Discrimination varies in its targets and intensity across cultures, but it is surprisingly similar in its rationalizations. Perhaps, he thought, the way we treat people we decide aren't like us isn't a product of our species culture or experience but something deeper, something that reacts how humans think, organize, and bound their social worlds. The most important principle of the subjective social order we construct for ourselves is the classy cation of groups as we and they, he wrote, and once someone has become a they, we are used to dismissing them, competing against them, discriminating against them and, Taillefer hypothesized in a particularly chilling sentence, we will do that even if there is no reason for it in terms of our own interests. It is worth dwelling on the radical conception of human nature Taillefer was advancing. People had long nurtured their prejudices, but they believed those prejudices reacted reality. We disliked those we disliked because we had reason to dislike them. This is the whole point of racial and ethnic stereotypes, the greed, criminality, venality, or idiocy we ascribe to others just as our hatred or fear of them. The post-Enlightenment view of humanity is that we are rational individuals whose actions may be inamed by instinct but are ultimately governed by calculation. But what if it was the other way around? What if our loyalties and prejudices are governed by instinct and merely rationalized as calculation? There is a reason Taillefer had these doubts. His life had taught him a cruel lesson in how thin the LM of human civilization really was, how near to the surface our barbarism lurked, and how IMC yet central group identity could be, how quickly it could shift from being meaningless to becoming the only thing that mattered. Taillefer was a Polish Jew, born in 1919. He immigrated to France in the 1930s because Jews couldn't get a university education in Poland. With World War II ripping through Europe, he joined the French army in 1939 and was captured by the Germans in 1940. He spent the next V years in German prisoner of war camps. All through this period he lived under the false identity of being French, wrote his student and collaborator John Turner. Had it been discovered by the German authorities that he was a Polish rather than a French Jew, he would have been killed too. This became, Turner later recalled, the base layer of Taillefer's zashin on identity. The point he made was that no matter what his personal characteristics were or the quality of his personal relationships with the German guards, once his true identity had been discovered, it was that social category membership, of being Polish, which would have determined the reaction of the guards and his ultimate fate. His personal attributes and identity as a unique individual would have proved unimportant and irrelevant to their response. Taillefer returned to France in May 1945. Hardly anyone I knew in 1939, including my family, was left alive, he later recalled. Point 3, and why had his parents been murdered? Why was his brother killed? The answer, for them, was the same as the answer for 6 million other Jews: they were Jewish. It is not hard to understand why a man who endured this era, who survived only by slipping into an identity that was not his own, would end himself obsessing over the psychology of group identity. Taillefer theorized that the instinct to view our own with favor and outsiders with hostility is so deeply learned that it operates independent of any reason to treat social relations as a competition. We do not need to hate or fear members of an outgroup to turn on them. We do not need to have anything material to gain by turning on them. Once we have classified them as, well, them, that is enough. We will end ourselves inclined to treat them skeptically, even hostilely, because that is what we are used to doing with anyone we see as a them. It's an automatic response, like the goose ash that rises on your arm in reaction to the cold. As a theory, it was elegant, if a bit grim. But it raised two predictions Teufel realized he could test experimentally. The RST was that we were so tuned to sort the world into us and them that we would do so based on the lightest of cues. The second was that once we had sorted the world into us and them, we would act with favor toward our group and discriminate against the out-group even in the absence of any reason to do so. Atop this theory, Teufel conducted a series of famous experiments that would be farcical were the results not so chilling. In the RST, 64 boys between the ages of 14 and 15 were invited to Teufel's laboratory. The children all came from the same school, so they came into the experiment knowing one another, already belonging to a community together. In the study's RST portion, the boys were told the researchers wanted to test visual judgment. They were shown clusters of dots and asked to estimate how many they saw. They then sat and watched as the researchers busily pretended to score their work. Then the researchers said they wanted to take advantage of the boys' presence to run another test, one that was in no way related to the RST. To make life simpler, they were going to sort the boys into groups based on whether they had guessed high or low when judging dots in the previous study. In reality, this was shown, the boys were split completely at random. The new task consisted of handing out a limited amount of real money to other boys in the study. The boys never gave themselves money, they were just allocating it to others. But they could see whether they were giving it to members of their group or the out-group. It is worth pausing here to emphasize the absurdity of the situation. 64 boys, all from the same school, were brought into a lab and sorted into groups based on a meaningless characteristic how accurately they estimated dots on a screen that wasn't even true. Then they were moved into a Dehrent study that had nothing to do with dots at all, where they were giving away money, none of which they would ever get. It was the lightest test of group identity possible. It was so light that Teufel did not expect it to generate group behavior. His idea was to establish a baseline of no intergroup behavior and then to add variables cumulatively to see at what point intergroup discrimination occurred, wrote Turner. 4. In other words, this RST experiment, with this silly categorization, was meant to be below the bar at which collective identity took hold, so Teufel could then add stronger cues and pinpoint what it took to make people see themselves as part of a group. Here, even Teufel, despite his tragic past, was underestimating the power of group psychology. The results of this RST test showed group identity taking hold and mutating into bias. A large majority of the subjects, in all groups in both conditions, gave more money to members of their own group than to members of the other group. 5. Importantly, this was not the optimal strategy for getting the most out of the experimenters, and it was not the strategy the boys chose when they weren't thinking in groups. When told they were choosing between two members of their own group, they tended to choose the fairest option. But when it was between a member of their meaningless group and the other meaningless group, they opted to make sure their CO over or CO underestimator, whose name they didn't even know, got more, even if it meant everyone got less in total. The results were so striking that Teufel decided he needed to do a second study to make sure they held. Once again, he invited a bunch of boys into the lab. This time, the boys were shown paintings by Paul Klee and Vasily Kandinsky and asked to choose their favorite. The paintings were shown without signatures so that the boys could then be sorted, at random, into the Klee group or the Kandinsky group as the researchers moved to the next experiment. Once again, the boys were asked to hand out money, knowing nothing other than that they were often allocating between participants who agreed with their taste in art and participants who didn't, and even that thin reed of group identity was false. But this time, the setup was designed to test whether making money for their group or screwing over the outsiders was more important for the assembled kids. In some scenarios, the boys would have to choose between maximizing the amount of money everyone received and maximizing how much more their group got, even if it meant their group got less in total. The latter proved the more popular option. Re-ECT on that for a second, they preferred to give their group less so long as it meant the gap between what they got and what the out-group got was bigger. Some of the boys did not choose between an out-group and in-group member. Instead, they were asked to choose between two members of their group or between two members of the out-group. In those cases, there was no longer group competition to drive behavior. But here, too, the results were telling. The boys giving money to two members of their group gave more than when they were giving money to two members of the out-group. Even now, Tehfel's description of the boys' decision to punish out-group members even when there was no in-group member to give money to rings with astonishment. There was no scarcity driving their decisions. That they still chose to punish the out-group represented, therefore, a clear case of gratuitous discrimination. 6. In a 1971 paper reacting on these results, Tehfel and his co-authors wrote that it was time to put to rest the idea that group conflict was primarily motivated by zero-sum collisions over resources or power. Discriminatory intergroup behavior cannot be fully understood if it is considered solely in terms of objective conflict of interests, they concluded. 7. The boys in his studies often had nothing to gain and sometimes even had something to lose by punishing those they believed, based on IMC and false categorizations, to be different from them. Far from their behavior showing a pure desire to maximize their group's gains, they often gave their group less to increase the difference between them and the out-group. Far from the money being the prime motivator, it is the winning that seems more important to them, wrote Tehfel. Again, these results were looking at boys who knew one another, who had no prior attachment to the meaningless groups they were randomly sorted into, who were allocating money that they knew they themselves would never get. But before you comfort yourself by saying that this is just a few experiments with some random teenage boys, that no adult would act this way, it's worth looking at one sphere of human life in which this behavior plays out constantly around us. I to hate like this is to be happy forever. It is time for me to admit something that I know will cost me the respect of some readers. I am not a sports fan. More than that, I don't understand sports fandom. I've tried. I have adopted teams, gone to games. When I was a kid, I obsessively collected baseball cards, rattling the stats of favored players. But I've never been able to develop allegiance. I grew up near Los Angeles, after the Rams had absconded to St. Louis too, so I knew these organizations had no loyalty to me. I liked following drafts and trades, and I saw that the players went where the money was rather than staying where their fans were. But I am weird and broken. Sports remain ubiquitous, and they are ubiquitous because they respond to human beings' deep desire to sort us from them, to see our group triumph over outsiders in combat and competition. Whether our team wins has no effect on our incomes, our futures, our children's education, or whether our job will move to China. But every week, millions, perhaps even billions, attach their happiness to the outcome of a game that they are not playing, whose material spoils they will not enjoy. They are not just watching for sportsmanship or prowess, they are watching, as Tehfel said, because it is the winning that is important. The winning is so important that cities burn and people die in its aftermath. In 2015, 538's Carl Bialik collected information on 49 recent North American sports riots. The database tells a violent history of the aftermath of many sporting events, thousands of people arrested, hundreds injured, more than a dozen killed. The riots occurred in more than a dozen U.S. states and three Canadian provinces, in reaction to sporting events in all four major North American pro sports, plus college football, basketball, and hockey. 8. Again, this is all for contests in which the stakes are purely psychological and emotional, and yet the ecstasy of victory, and sometimes the pain of loss, so overwhelms our faculties that we destroy the very towns that form the basis of our action for the teams we're supporting. This is how powerfully we attach to groups. This is how little it takes for group identity to take over all our other faculties, for identitarian passions to push aside the tinny voice of our reasoning mind. In 2006, Will Blythe published a book with a title I have never forgotten. It was called To Hate Like This Is To Be Happy Forever. How can you walk by a book with those words slashed across the cover? What could it be about? When I picked it up, I was surprised to see that it was an exploration of the rivalry between the Duke and University of North Carolina basketball teams and the way that rivalry had given shape and meaning to the author's life in moments when little else did. The living and dying through one's allegiance to either Duke or Carolina is no less real for being enacted through play and fandom, Blythe writes. 9. I love that line. The living and dying through one's allegiance. If it sounds like hyperbole, consider the possibility that the emotional experience it describes is not just real, but rational. Human beings evolved to exist in groups. To be part of a group, and to see that group thrive, meant survival. To be exiled from a group, or to see your group crushed by its enemies, could mean death. Is it really so strange that we evolved to feel the life and death stakes of group belonging and status? The emergent science of loneliness offers powerful insight here. We tend to dismiss the agony of social isolation or stigma as merely psychological. It isn't. To feel abandoned by community, to fear the opprobrium of others, triggers a physical assault on the body. You may have heard statistics like loneliness is worse for you than obesity or smoking. Medical professionals, like Vivek Murthy, the former Surgeon General of the United States, say social isolation acts like a disease or an injury, crossing from psychological state to physical malady. The mechanism is evolutionary. Our brains know we need our groups to survive. So when we feel cast out of our group, it triggers a massive stress response throughout the body. From a biological perspective, we evolved to be social creatures. Long ago, our ability to build relationships of trust and cooperation helped increase our chances of having a stable food supply and more consistent protection from predators. Over thousands of years, the value of social connection has become baked into our nervous system such that the absence of such a protective force creates a stress state in the body. Loneliness causes stress, and long-term or chronic stress leads to more frequent elevations of a key stress hormone, cortisol. It is also linked to higher levels of inflammation in the body. This in turn damages blood vessels and other tissues, increasing the risk of heart disease, diabetes, joint disease, depression, obesity, and premature death. Chronic stress can also hijack your brain's prefrontal cortex, which governs decision-making, planning, emotional regulation, analysis, and abstract thinking. 10. There's a particular ending in this research that's almost unbearably poignant. As Johann Hari describes in his book Lost Connections, anywhere in the world where people describe being lonely, they will also throughout their sleep experience more of something called microawakenings. These are small moments you won't recall when you wake up, but in which you rise a little from your slumber. All other social animals do the same thing when they're isolated too. The best theory is that you don't feel safe going to sleep when you're lonely, because early humans literally weren't safe if they were sleeping apart from the tribe. 11. That's how deep the experience of social anxiety runs. It literally wakes you up throughout the night, because your body knows it can't rest as deeply when it can't rely on others for protection. Our brains reset deep evolutionary time, while our lives, for better and for worse, are lived right now, in this moment. We are exquisitely tuned to understand and manage our role in the small, necessary groups that denied our world as hunter-gatherers, but we've not had long to adjust to the digitized, globalized, accelerated world we've built. The sensitivities that helped us thrive within the interplay of a few groups of a few hundred people can drive us mad when exposed to the scale, noise, and sophisticated manipulations of modern capitalism and politics. Our brains don't always know the difference between the life and death stakes that group fortunes once held and the milder consequences they typically carry today. In his book Enlightenment 2.0, Restoring Sanity to Our Politics, Our Economy, and Our Lives, University of Toronto philosopher Joseph Heath frames this nicely. When it comes to large-scale cooperation, we humans have clearly exceeded our programming. We have become what biologists call an ultra-social species, despite having a set of social instincts that are essentially tailored for managing life in a small-scale tribal society. It's crucial to recognize, however, that we have not accomplished this by reprogramming ourselves or overcoming our innate design limitations. We have accomplished this in large measure by tricking ourselves into feeling as though we are still living in small-scale tribal societies, even when we are not. Unfortunately, the trick works so well that we sometimes forget that we're using it, and so imagine that we can create large-scale systems of cooperation based on nothing more than our rational insight into the need for such institutions. This invariably leads to disappointment. Point 12. I would amend that. It doesn't invariably lead to disappointment. Sometimes it leads to large-scale, wonderful advances in human cooperation, like the nation-state or religions. Sometimes it leads to hatred, violence, even genocide. And sometimes it just leads to everyone gathering on Sunday to watch two groups of people dressed in particular colors collide with each other on a lush green eld. I worry, writing this section, that some will read it and believe I am dismissing the power, or condescending to the experience, of sports rivalries. So let me say this clearly, my point is just the opposite. Sports are such a powerful force in human society precisely because they harness primal instincts that pulse through our psyche. The fact that teams can command such deep, violent loyalty based on nothing but being in the same town as fans, even as professional sports teams are transparently cynical in their loyalties, even as they demand stadium subsidies to locate and tax breaks to remain in the towns they profess to love, even as the players leave the moment another team offers a better deal, shows that we are no different from TFL's boys. A group does not have to be based on objectively important criteria for it to become an important part of our self-identity and for it to inspire loathing of those who stand outside its boundaries. Another objection to this argument might be that sports are, well, sports. They are competition distilled to its purest form. They construct a world where for one side to win, the other must lose. It's unfair to compare that with politics, isn't it? Politics is a team sport. In 2015, Patrick R. Miller and Pamela Johnston Conover published a paper entitled Red and Blue States of Mind. The paper looks at how Republicans and Democrats, as well as independents who lean toward one party or the other, act during elections. What motivates them? What do they feel? What drives them to participate? The behavior of partisans resembles that of sports team members acting to preserve the status of their teams rather than thoughtful citizens participating in the political process for the broader good, the paper concludes. Point 13. Yikes. The authors tested behavior in two stages. In the RST, they looked at partisan action through the prism of feelings of anger toward, and rivalry with, the other party. Using mountains of survey data and pre- and post-election polling of the same groups, they tested the EECT issue positions, ideology, age, education, political knowledge, church attendance, gender, partisan identity, race, and more had on a person's likelihood of feeling fury and competition in the midst of an election. They found that while high-minded factors like policy ideas and ideology played some role in how partisans felt, the overwhelming driver was the strength of partisan identity. Elections accentuate the team mentality of party identity, pushing them repeatedly to make us-them comparisons between Democrats and Republicans that draw attention to what will be lost status if the election is not won, write Miller and Conover. This results in both rivalry and anger. The next question Miller and Conover considered was whether those feelings led to actions. So they ran a similar test, looking at how the same host of political forces, identities, and ideas drove a Republican or Democrat's likelihood of helping on a campaign or actually turning out to vote. Here, again, partisan identity dominated when compared to abstractions like issue positions or ideology. But then Miller and Conover did something interesting. They asked people to RECT on how much anger, rivalry, and incivility they felt toward the other side. Once they added those answers into their data, the EECT of every other political factor plummeted. How we feel matters much more than what we think, and in elections, the feelings that matter most are often our feelings about the other side. Negative partisanship rears its head again. The big picture that emerges from this paper is that the people actually driving elections, the people knocking on doors, working for campaigns, and turning out to vote, are driven more by group rivalry than by tax policy. Miller and Conover are crisp on this point. When partisans endure meetings, plant yard signs, write checks, and spend endless hours volunteering, what is likely foremost in their minds is that they are furious with the opposing party and want intensely to avoid losing to it, not a specific issue agenda. They are red-up team members on a mission to defeat the other team. A 2016 Pew survey backed up these endings and their centrality to politics. 14 Among Republicans, moving from a mostly unfavorable view of the Democratic Party to a very unfavorable view increased the likelihood of regular voting by 12 points. By contrast, developing a deeper affection for the Republican Party increased regular voting among Republicans by only 6 points. Democrats didn't show the same EECT increases in negative and positive partisanship drove voting at similar rates. But the data turned even starker as Pew moved up the ladder of engagement. When Republicans were asked whether they had contributed money to a candidate or group in the past few years, a very unfavorable view of Democrats raised the likelihood by 11 points, while a very favorable view of Republicans increased it by only 3. Among Democrats, a very unfavorable view of Republicans increased it by 8 points, while a very favorable view of their own party didn't increase it at all. All of this points toward an important principle: the most engaged experience politics differently than everyone else. In the previous chapter I mentioned the book Open versus Closed, which indicates that the least engaged voters tend to look at politics through the lens of material self-interest, what will this policy do for me, while the most engaged look at politics through the lens of identity, what does support for this policy position say about me? This helps illuminate a long-running debate, particularly on the left, about whether working-class voters who pull the lever for Republicans are betraying their self-interest in voting for a party that will cut taxes on the rich and break the unions that protect the poor. What Johnston, Lavin, and Federico indicate is that as people become more involved and invested in politics, the self-interest they're looking to satisfy changes. It's a mistake to imagine our bank accounts are the only reasonable drivers of political action. As we become more political, we become more interested in politics as a means of self-expression and group identity. It is not that citizens are unable to recognize their interests, they write, rather, it is that material concerns are often irrelevant to the individual's goals when forming a policy opinion. 15 Politicians, of course, are not equally responsive to all their constituents. They are most concerned about the most engaged, the people who will vote for them, volunteer for them, donate to them. And the way to make more of that kind of voter isn't just to focus on how great you are. It's to focus on how bad the other side is. Nothing brings a group together like a common enemy. Remove the fury and fear of a real opponent, and watch the enthusiasm drain from your supporters. In 2017, Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke launched a long-shot Senate bid against Ted Cruz, one of the Democratic Party's bete noirs. O'Rourke's candidacy was a sensation. He raised the most money ever recorded for a Senate race. He packed rafters, went viral. On Election Day, Beyoncé posted a photo on Instagram, wearing a Beto hat. O'Rourke lost by 3 points, but the groundswell of support convinced him to run for president. He entered the Democratic 2020 primary with great fanfare and big fundraising numbers, but he quickly plummeted in the polls. Strategic mistakes explain some of his struggles, but O'Rourke was the same candidate, and the same man, in 2019 as in 2018. The catalytic ingredient in his Senate campaign was liberal loathing of Cruz, the thrill that he might be defeated. When O'Rourke was running against other Democrats, his personal charisma failed to recapture the magic of his Senate race. This is not to take away from the political power of inspiration. The most effective politicians thrill their supporters. But they do so in the context of the threat their opponents pose. And as politicians become less well-known and capable on the stump, they rely more and more heavily on activating fear of the other side. The lesson is known by politicians the world over. You don't just need support. You need anger. That's why fundraising emails often border on the apocalyptic. A few of the recent subject lines in the emails I've received from the Republican National Committee, in support of Trump's re-election campaign, fake news. Americans must fight back, and my personal favorite, FW, stolen. Caps lock in the original, of course. It's why Trump is always gting with the media. It's why presidential candidates ND it hard to keep their supporters engaged when they win the White House. The terror of losing an election is more viscerally motivating than the compromises of daily governance. What all this suggests is that one of the most important questions in American politics is how strong our group identities are, how much we feel we belong to one team and how much we fear losing to the other team. But what if it's not just one team we belong to? What if it's many teams, and what if all those teams begin working together? Identities Politic. In 2004, Barack Obama gave that rarest of things, a speech that literally changed the course of American history. If John Kerry hadn't tapped Obama to keynote the Democratic National Convention, Obama wouldn't have become a national political superstar while still an Illinois state senator. If he hadn't become a national political superstar, he wouldn't have run for president in his RST term as U.S. Senator. And if he hadn't run for president, well, you get the point. That speech wasn't just a neat bit of rhetoric. It was an argument about the structure of polarization. Even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us, he said, the spin masters and negative ad peddlers who embrace the politics of anything goes. Notice the rhetorical move Obama makes. We are not divided. We can only be divided. The polarizers are out there. We are their victims, our disagreements their product. He goes on to deny their dark arts, to argue that the country is not what they make us think it is. There's not a liberal America and a conservative America, there's the United States of America, he says. There's not a black America and white America and Latino America and Asian America, there's the United States of America. And as for the pundits who like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states, that would be me, I fear Obama had news for them. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around our libraries in the red states. Of every politician I have covered, of every politician I have met, Obama is the most thoughtful and reactive, the best at seeing American politics with historical perspective and analytical altitude. His position on this was considered. He didn't just dislike polarization, he doubted it. And why wouldn't he? If you were a skinny black kid with the middle name Hussein who shot from state senate to president of the United States in 4 years, it, wouldn't you? His life story was, itself, a rebuttal of polarization's coarse logic. This was the secret to his political success. He could speak to the best in America because he believed the best of America. He was like the friend who looked at you and saw the version of yourself you wanted to be. But the paradox of Obama's political career is that he himself was a polarizing guru. In 2015, I interviewed him in the White House. By that point, he was the most polarizing president in the history of polling, breaking the record George W. Bush had set before him and that Bill Clinton had set before Bush. The crown now belongs to Trump, in case you were wondering. I believe Obama had sincerely tried to pursue a politics that he thought would foster compromise or at least understanding. But he had failed. So I asked him what advice he would give his successor about tamping down on polarization, a question that rings with dark irony today, given the way Trump pursues polarization as an explicit political strategy. Even so, I've struggled with Obama's answer in the years since. There are a couple of things that in my mind, at least, contribute to our politics being more polarized than people actually are, Obama said. And I think most people just sense this in their daily lives. Everybody's got a family member or a really good friend from high school who is on the complete opposite side of the political spectrum. And yet, we still love them, right? Everybody goes to a soccer game, or watching their kids, coaching, and they see parents who they think are wonderful people. And then if they made a comment about politics, suddenly they'd go, I can't believe you think that. 16 Obama's point here is that our political identities are not our only identities. And our other identities, little league coach, PTA member, parent, are a lot less polarized than our political identities. Take me. I am an American, Jewish, Caucasian, male, Californian. My father is a Brazilian immigrant, so I care deeply about immigration, feel a familial attachment to Brazil, and find it relaxing to listen to English spoken in a Portuguese accent. I'm a husband, a father, and a dog owner, and you can activate any of those identities by criticizing my wife or my son or praising cats. I lived in Washington, D.C., 14 years and tend to get defensive when others criticize it. I'm a journalist who is critical of my profession but protective of it when challenged. I'm a vegan, and because I think animal suffering is important and horribly ignored, I try to be at least somewhat strident about it. Then there are the parts of my personality that seem like preferences but can act like identities when challenged. I grew up using Apple computers, and I remember spending endless time arguing their superiority to PCs, in ways that far outstripped the importance of the question. 317 I dislike Manhattan, and that dislike comes out particularly strongly when people praise Manhattan as superior to places I've lived and love, which people in Manhattan do all the damn time. I'm an anxious person, and that's become, over time, part of how I understand myself, not just something I feel. I mention these not because they're as powerful as, say, fatherhood is for me, but because the line between what is and isn't an identity is fuzzier than we often think. If you don't believe me, spend some time watching television commercials and ask yourself whether they're advertising products or identities. All of these are identities that can be called forth in me on a moment's notice. Some of them are strong identities that I could imagine driving me to violence if sufficiently threatened. Some of them are weak identities I could imagine being persuaded to abandon. Some situate me in a certain political camp. Others cross all boundaries. But they are all in me, simultaneously, and they interact in powerful and unpredictable ways. Obama argued that polarized media, gerrymandering, and the hood of political money tended to balkanize us into our political identities. So my advice to a future president, he said, is increasingly try to bypass the traditional venues that create divisions and try to ND new venues within this new media that are quirkier, less predictable. 18 Obama was O-airing the right explanation for polarization from the wrong angle. He's right that it's all about which identities get activated, and he's right that our political identities are more polarized than our other identities. But he was too optimistic in believing that our non-political identities could become our political identities, that they were somehow a truer reaction of our essential selves, and thus strong enough to overwhelm our partisan divisions. In practice, our political identities are polarizing our other identities, too. In her book Uncivil Agreement, Liliana Mason sums up the state of American politics and perhaps American life in a single, searing paragraph. The American political parties are growing socially polarized. Religion and race, as well as class, geography, and culture, are dividing the parties in such a way that the EECT of party identity is magni ed. The competition is no longer between only Democrats and Republicans. A single vote can now indicate a person's partisan preference as well as his or her religion, race, ethnicity, gender, neighborhood, and favorite grocery store. This is no longer a single social identity. Partisanship can now be thought of as a mega identity, with all the psychological and behavioral magni cations that implies. 19 Up until now, I've largely talked about the polarization of American politics in terms of its objective demographic and ideological dimensions. The key point Mason is making, though, is that those traits also operate as identities, and in coming together, they fuse into a single sense of self. Living in a city, being a liberal, shopping at Trader Joe's, and dabbling in Zen meditation may not have much to do with one another in terms of public policy, but they reinforce a singular identity, and that identity is political, or at least easily politicized. In 2004, the Club for Growth, a conservative interest group that advocates for lower taxes and deregulation, ran a famous ad against then-presidential candidate Howard Dean. In the ad, an older white couple is stopped outside a shop with patriotic bunting and asked about Dean's plan to raise taxes. "What do I think?" the man replies. "Well, I think Howard Dean should take his tax hiking, government expanding, latte drinking, sushi eating, Volvo driving, New York Times reading." Then his wife cuts in, body piercing, Hollywood loving, left-wing freak show back to Vermont, where it belongs. And that, my friends, is pure, uncut mega-identity politics. 20 You can see, in that RI, the way political identity transcends mere partisanship. You may be a democratic socialist living in Berkeley, California, who dismisses Democrats as spineless corporatists. But you know that ad is an attack on you, anyway. Once you begin looking for weaponization of seemingly non-political identity markers, you ND them everywhere. I began this book trying to persuade you that something in American politics has changed, that though we still use the terms Democrat and Republican and liberal and conservative, our cleavages are dearer and deeper. This is what has changed. Our political identities have become political mega-identities. The merging of the identities means when you activate one, you often activate all, and each time they're activated, they strengthen. Obama used the example of Americans together at a soccer game. To shift it a bit, what about Americans together at a football game? That's one of those nice, depolarized identities. At least it was. But then some of the football players, led by 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, began kneeling during the national anthem to protest police violence. Trump took up the case, tweeting that they should be red. Democrats began defending them. Kaepernick was cut, and despite stats that should have gotten him a job on another team, no one would touch him, he later sued the NFL. In response, GQ made Kaepernick its Citizen of the Year. There is nothing intrinsically liberal about football. But after Kaepernick's protest became a national ash point, the NFL polarized. Before the controversy, about 60% of both Clinton and Trump voters viewed the NFL favorably. Amid the controversy, the NFL's favorability among Clinton voters was unchanged, but its favorability among Trump voters plummeted to 30% and disapproval spiked to over 60%. Nike then made Kaepernick its new spokesman, even though he was no longer playing football professionally. In response, Trump supporters burned Nike gear, and Trump tweeted, "Just like the NFL, whose ratings have gone way down, Nike is getting absolutely killed with anger and boycotts." 21 Football fandom used to be an identity that cut across politics. Democrats liked the sport. Republicans liked the sport. Even I, sports hater that I am, played nose tackle in high school. But when the NFL came into contact with politics, it became part of politics. Rather than a shared love of football pulling our political identities toward compromise, our political identities polarized our love of football. Intense supporters are catnip for brands, so Nike jumped into the fray, purposefully polarizing one of the biggest clothing brands in the world. And football fandom became, at least for a while, one more magnet in the political identity stack, attracting those on the left and repelling those on the right. When we share identities with each other, they can act as a bridge. You're a 90s kid and I'm a 90s kid, so let's talk about how the 90s were the best decade for music. But when our identities separate us from each other, they can be a moat, widening the distance between us. In 2002, psychologists Marilyn Brewer and Sonia Rockus showed that people with a lot of cross-cutting identities tended to be more tolerant of outsiders than people with highly aligned identities. Point 22. The insight here makes sense. The more your identities converge on a single point, the more your identities can be threatened simultaneously, and that makes con-ICT much more threatening. Imagine two Democrats. One of them, Rick, is white, straight, and conservative. He attends an evangelical church, lives in a rural area, and belongs to a union. The other, Sarah, is black, gay, and liberal. She's skeptical of religion, lives in Los Angeles, and identifies as a feminist. Rick, looking at the candidacy of George W. Bush, would ND some of his identities under threat. Bush is a Republican and hostile to unions, but other identities would modulate his panic. Like him, Bush is an evangelical Christian, a white man, a conservative, respectful of rural culture. John Kerry, meanwhile, is a pro-union Democrat, but he's also a liberal urbanite who evinced little understanding of rural America or the evangelical church. This is the kind of Democrat who would at least have considered voting for Bush. Sarah, by contrast, would look at Bush and see all her identities under threat simultaneously. He's a Republican, an evangelical, a white man, a conservative. He shows little respect for urban life, for atheists, and he backed a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriages. This is the kind of Democrat who would fear Bush, who would see him as a genuine danger to her life, who would do almost anything to see him defeated. This is the kind of Democrat who would volunteer for Kerry's campaign, who would donate money, who would seek out harshly anti-Bush punditry and believe it easily. Thus, though it seems that lots of deranged divisions would tear apart a society, it turns out that creating one bigger, deeper division, a megadivision, is more dangerous. Mason quotes the founder of American sociology Edward Allsworth Ross, writing in The Principles of Sociology, on this point, the chief oppositions which occur in society are between individuals, sexes, ages, races, nationalities, sections, classes, political parties, and religious sects. Several such may be in full swing at the same time, but the more numerous they are, the less menacing is any one. Every species of conflict interferes with every other species in society at the same time, save only when their lines of cleavage coincide, in which case they reinforce one another. A society, therefore, which is riven by a dozen oppositions along lines running in every direction, may actually be in less danger of being torn with violence or falling to pieces than one split along just one line. Point 23. This isn't just theory. A 2012 study by Joshua Gubler and Joel Sawatzelway surveyed data from more than 100 countries and found that civil war is an average of nearly 12 times less probable in societies where ethnicity is crosscut by socioeconomic class, geographic region, and religion. 24. One way to read this data is it's just another way of describing policy disagreement. As our identities diverge, our worldview and agendas diverge. So all this is just a proportional response to deepening deerances in self-interest. There's certainly some of that, but as Tafel found long ago, and as sports fans show every weekend, much of our hostility is a pure expression of how we instinctively treat out-groups. It doesn't need policy deerances to catalyze it. Mason tested this directly. Using American National Election Studies survey data, she looked at what made people likely to rate the other party higher or lower on a feelings thermometer that went from 1 to 100, where 1 was the coldest you could feel toward the other party and 100 was the warmest. Cleverly, she cut the data to see self-identified Republicans whose policy views should have made them Democrats. They gave the Republican Party a rating of between 60 and 70 and the Democratic Party a rating between 30 and 50. As for Democrats with conservative policy positions, they rated the Democratic Party between 60 and 80 and gave the Republican Party between a 30 and 50. Interestingly, it turns out that there's only a weak relationship between how much a person identifies as a conservative or liberal and how conservative or liberal their views actually are, to be exact. In both cases it's about a 0.25 correlation. One reason policy is not the driver of political disagreement is most people don't have very strong views about policy. It's the rare hobbyist who thinks often about cybersecurity and who should lead the Federal Reserve. But all of us are experts on our own identities. Over and again, Mason NDS that identity is far more powerful than issue positions in driving polarization. All else equal, if you compare people with the most moderate policy positions with those with the most cross-cutting identities, the policy moderates will be more than twice as unfriendly to the other party as those whose crossed identities are restraining their partisanship. That is to say, feeling closer to the other side in identity does more to calm dislike than feeling closer to the other side on policy. This is the American identity crisis, Mason writes. Not that we have partisan identities. We've always had those. The crisis emerges when partisan identities fall into alignment with other social identities, stoking our intolerance of each other to levels that are unsupported by our degrees of political disagreement. 25. The stakes of politics, of course, are very real, ghts over tax dollars, whether to go to war, whether to recognize same-sex marriages, whether to pass a universal health care bill. But those are stakes that we have to do a lot of thinking and learning to connect to. They are stakes that exist in the more recently evolved parts of our brain, stakes we must work to feel. Viscerally and emotionally, the stakes of politics we have evolved to sense is whether our group is winning or losing, whether the outgroup is gaining the power to threaten us or whether our allies are amassing the strength to ensure our safety and prosperity. As our many identities merge into single political mega-identities, those visceral, emotional stakes are rising and with them, our willingness to do anything to make sure our side wins. Political identity is fair game for hatred. Shanto Iyengar is director of Stanford University's Political Communication Laboratory, and he had noticed something odd. In 1960, Americans were asked whether they would be pleased, displeased, or unmoved if their son or daughter married a member of the other political party. Respondents reacted with a shrug. Only 5% of Republicans and 4% of Democrats said they would be upset by the cross-party union. On the list of things you might care about in a child's partner are they kind, smart, successful, supportive, which political party they voted for just didn't rate. Fast forward to 2008. The polling RM YouGov asked Republicans and Democrats the same question and got very different results. This time, 27% of Republicans and 20% of Democrats said they would be upset if their son or daughter married a member of the opposite party. In 2010, YouGov asked the question again, this time, 49% of Republicans and 33% of Democrats professed concern at inter-party marriage. The numbers suggested to Iyengar that today's political differences were fundamentally different from yesterday's political differences. The nature of American political partisanship, he worried, was mutating into something more fundamental, and more irreconcilable, than what it had been in the past. If he was right, then party affiliation wasn't simply an expression of our disagreements, it was also becoming the cause of them. If Democrats thought of other Democrats as their group and of Republicans as a hostile outgroup, and vice versa, then the consequences would stretch far beyond politics into things like, say, marriage. And the data was everywhere. Polls looking at the difference between how Republicans viewed Democrats and how Democrats viewed Republicans now showed that partisans were less accepting of each other than white people were of black people or than black people were of white people. But there was no way partisanship and identity we choose and sometimes change could possibly have become a cleavage in American life as deep as race, right? That seemed crazy. So Iyengar decided to test it. The experiment was simple. Working with Dartmouth College political scientist Sean Westwood, Iyengar asked about 1,000 people to decide between the resumes of two high school seniors who were competing for a scholarship. The resumes could differ in three ways. RST, the senior could have either a 3.5 or 4.0 GPA. Second, the senior could have been the president of the Young Democrats or Young Republicans Club. Third, the senior could have a stereotypically African-American name and have been president of the African-American Student Association or could have a stereotypically Caucasian name. The point of the project was to see whether political hostility affected a non-political task and to compare the EECT with race. I've read a lot of studies in the course of researching this book, but this one still surprises me. When the resume included a political identity cue, about 80% of Democrats and Republicans awarded the scholarship to their co-partisan. This held true whether or not the co-partisan had the higher GPA. When the Republican student was more quali-ed, Democrats chose him only 30% of the time, and when the Democrat was more quali-ed, Republicans chose him only 15% of the time. That is a profound ending. When awarding a college scholarship a task that should be completely non-political, Republicans and Democrats cared more about the political party of the student than the student's GPA. As Iyengar and Westwood wrote, partisanship simply trumped academic excellence. 26. Remarkably, in this study, partisanship even trumped race. When the candidates were equally quali-ed, about 78% of African Americans chose the candidate of the same race, as did 42% of white Americans. When the candidate of the other race had a higher GPA, 45% of African Americans chose him, as did 71% of white Americans. Iyengar's hypothesis is that partisan animosity is one of the few forms of discrimination that contemporary American society not only permits but actively encourages. Political identity is fair game for hatred, he says. Racial identity is not. Gender identity is not. You cannot express negative sentiments about social groups in this day and age. But political identities are not protected by these constraints. A Republican is someone who chooses to be Republican, so I can say whatever I want about them. 27. You can see an example when you look at the media, Westwood observes. There are no major cable channels devoted to making people of other races look bad, though Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham get pretty close sometimes. But there are cable channels that are devoted to making members of the other party look bad. The media has become tribal leaders, he says. They're telling the tribe how to identify and behave, and we're following along. 28. Westwood is quick to note that the comparison to racism doesn't mean that partisanship is somehow worse than racism, more pervasive, or more damaging. It's easier to see and thus discriminate against people based on their skin color than their partisanship, for instance. Moreover, political beliefs are a choice with moral implications while race is not. Judging someone on whether they support gay marriage, universal health care, or gun laws is far different from judging someone on the color of their skin. Still, Iyengar and Westwood's research is a fundamental challenge to the way we like to believe American politics works. A world where we won't give an out-party high schooler with a better GPA a non-political scholarship is not a world in which we're going to listen to politicians on the other side of emotional, controversial issues even if they're making good arguments that are backed by the facts. Iyengar and Westwood's research is confirmation of the way TFL thought people worked. Here, again, we have people in a room, sorted by identities with no relationship to the task at hand, and using what power they have to reward the in-group and punish the out-group. The old theory was political parties came into existence to represent deep social cleavages, Iyengar says. But now party politics has taken on a life of its own. Now it is the cleavage 29, a life of its own. It reminds me of something else Tafel wrote, way back in 1970. Social scientists had created a distinction between rational and irrational forms of group conflict. As Tafel described it, the former is a means to an end, the conflict and the attitudes that go with it represent a genuine competition between groups with divergent interests. The latter is an end in itself, it serves to release accumulated emotional tensions of various kinds. But, Tafel went on to say, the distinction between the two kinds of hostility was less clear than his profession thought, because they reinforce each other in a relentless spiral. 30. This is, I think, the best way to understand the relationship between policy differences and identity conflict. They're mutually reinforcing, not opposed. Take immigration. Hispanics have become a more powerful and central part of the Democratic coalition. That's partly why Obama made the decision to protect law-abiding Dreamers from deportation. That decision, which angered many Republicans, is part of what opened space for Trump to run an insurgent primary campaign heavy on anti-immigrant, pro-white rhetoric. In OCE, Trump has pushed a raft of anti-immigrant policies including canceling Obama's protections for Dreamers, which has both upended Democrats on a moral level and pushed Hispanics yet more into the Democratic column, making them more powerful in the Democratic Party. As a result, Democrats have increasingly united behind both pro-immigrant policies and pro-immigrant values to the extent that most of the 2020 presidential candidates endorsed decriminalizing unauthorized border crossing and giving undocumented immigrants access to public health insurance, both unthinkable policies in the Democratic Party even a few years earlier. Behind the endorsement of these ideas is the Democrats' changing identity as a party that believes in diversity and welcomes immigrants, both documented and undocumented, as woven into the American narrative. In 2019, I interviewed Julian Castro, the former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, who was then running for president. I see undocumented immigrants as being a part of the American story for generations, including this generation, Castro told me. I see them as integral to building a strong future for the country. I always talk about the fact that, in many ways, we need undocumented immigrants, whether we want to admit it or not. 31. What might have started as a limited question of immigration policy has become central to the conflict between the two parties. It's not just about what the coalitions want to do, it's about who they are, what they believe, who counts as their we. But identity doesn't just shape how we treat each other. It shapes how we understand the world. I should note that Teufel's results have been replicated repeatedly, in all sorts of conditions, deploying all sorts of group identities, using adults as subjects. But permit me a smooth section transition. The team has since returned, which I'd say further proves my point.